Hi, I'm Carrie. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank you all for having me here. It's been an interesting trip. I've been up for 24 hours, so I'm going to try and behave myself up here. But I can't guarantee that. I start getting a little off after about, 20 hours of no sleep. So let me start off and say, ask God to put the words in my mouth and love in my heart and help me to speak the truth. My sobriety date is September 6th, 1994. My home group is a Way Out group in Tannersville, Pennsylvania. My sponsor's name is Peggy. Whenever I give a talk, those are three things that I always say, because it reminds me that these are not... A sobriety date, obviously, is really important. When one wants to stay sober, we have to stop drinking. Two, we have to get a sponsor that carries this message, that works the program of recovery, because there's something called the fellowship, which is what we're doing right here. This is the fellowship. We're hanging out. We're having coffee. We're talking. We're doing this thing. And then there's the program of recovery, which is what we do with our sponsors, which are the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so we need all of these three things in order to produce the spiritual experience that one must have in order to recover from alcoholism. So I'm going to talk about the doctor's opinion. And what I'm going to try to do, and what I like to do when I do things like this, is not turn this into a big book study, because the fact is that if you're sitting here and the information that you're getting about the big book is from me, from this podium, something's wrong, because sponsorship is key. My job is to disturb and inform you about what alcoholism is, what it does, and what one needs to do to recover. But what happens, or that recovery that happens, is between two alcoholics when they sit down together and they work for a common purpose. And that common purpose is to get closer to one's higher power. Because it's through that relationship with a higher power that one recovers from alcoholism. Now, I'm a recovered alcoholic because I no longer have the obsession of the mind, and I no longer put alcohol in my body. And for me, that is the greatest gift or promise that one, that an alcoholic could ever get. And the idea here is this, is if I had to come into Alcoholics Anonymous and stay here and be unhappy and be miserable and just not drink, I don't think I would have stayed here, because I have this progressive spiritual disease that's continually kicking my butt. I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, and self-pity. I step on the toes of my fellows. They retaliate, seemingly without provocation, but at some time in the past, they made a decision based on self that placed me in the position to be hurt. So basically, every time I'm hurt, I'm usually asking for it. That's just basically the boil down to that. So the idea here is I have all these self-created problems, and I'm going to continue to create these problems because I have a spiritual malady. And we're going to talk about that later today. But when we're talking about the doctor's opinion, the reason why I touch on this is because there are three parts to the disease of alcoholism. There's the physical craving, there's the mental obsession, and there's the spiritual malady. And the doctor's opinion touches on all three parts of alcoholism. And if you really want to look at, if you want a good distillation of what the symptoms or the earmark of an alcoholic, what they are, all you have to do is really look in that chapter. Because the doctor points out the physical allergy. He says that the craving, he uses the word craving, but what he means is abnormal reaction to alcohol, meaning when I put alcohol in my system, my body metabolizes alcohol differently than other people. What that means, and here, this is, I remember being in gym class. In America, we have something called sex ed, health ed, where there's one semester of the year where you sit around and you talk about STDs and drugs. And they tell you not to have sex, and they tell you to not do drugs, which, of course, most of people like myself use it as an information gathering session and say, ooh, LSD does what? Note to self. So when you're in junior high school, they sit you down and they tell you all about this stuff. And I remember being in this class, and I remember them talking about alcohol and saying that it was a central nervous system depressant. And I remember thinking, that's not the experience that I have with alcohol. I don't go down. It's not a downer for me. In fact, when I put alcohol in my system, I feel alive. I like the words, and I've heard it so many times, I get right when I put alcohol in my system. The average drinker, the average person who's not an alcoholic doesn't react that way to alcohol. I have a sister. She's not an alcoholic. She's a wonderful, beautiful human being. She does normal things. And she says things like, I want a nightcap. I don't know what that is. She says things like, I'm finished with this, and I'm, you know, she'll drink a glass of wine and she'll put it on the table and she'll be like, I'm done. So that's not a word in my vocabulary, especially regarding alcohol. She'll say things like, I just want to relax with a glass of wine. And I remember I went on a cruise with her, and I'm sober. At this time, I'm sober maybe 10 years, and we're in the Bahamas. And she's got this, she went and she got this beautiful bottle of wine that, you know, she picked it out and she got it. She smuggled it back onto the ship. I didn't say she was honest. I just said she wasn't an alcoholic. So she smuggled this alcohol back onto the cruise ship and she's got it in our cabin and she's got this little glass and this bottle with a cork in it. And every night she pours out two fingers, she drinks it and she goes to bed. And I remember just watching her do this one night, thinking, whoa, how are we related? That is not my experience. She's like, and in this, in the context of this, we start talking and she starts asking me, and I've been sober for, you know, a decade. And I'm very quiet in my family regarding what I do in Alcoholics Anonymous. Not because I am ashamed or anything like that, but I think my actions speak louder than my words. And so she started asking me, she's like, you know, can you ever drink? And I'm like, no. She's like, why? And this is where when the book talks about it, it says that this type of drinking or this type of craving, this type of physical reaction that alcoholics have to alcohol is limited to this class of drinker, meaning the alcoholic, and never occurs in the average temperate drinker, because in this conversation we're talking and she completely does not understand the experience that I have with alcohol and I don't understand hers. So I have this physical craving and basically what happens is I put alcohol in my body. I go up and I want more. I get right. When I don't have alcohol in my body, I'm something called irritable, restless, and discontent, meaning that I don't know where you end and I begin, and I feel like I have no skin. You ever, like, walk around? You ever have one of those days when everything, when people think at you, where they're looking at you, they're thinking at you, everything's about you, and, like, and everything's really loud, and your head is screaming? Ever have a day like that? That's me when I can't drink and I don't have God. Now, the big book says that alcoholics drink essentially because they like the effect that alcohol produces, right? That though we admit is injurious, that after a time we can't differentiate the true from the false. So the things that I told myself about my drinking, such as it was my parents' fault, if you had my life, you'd drink like this, or I don't care. I mean, I think towards the end of my drinking, it wasn't so much about blaming other people for my drinking, was simply the fact that I could not give a crap about the consequences of my drinking because the pain that I was in before I put alcohol in my system was so great that whatever could possibly happen didn't matter because the hell that I felt being me at that moment overwhelmed any possible rational thought that I would have regarding alcohol. You know, basically I drank to get relief because I could not be me and not want to kill myself every moment of every day. I just wanted to die. And it wasn't a blatant, you know, I did die for 2 minutes, but that's a whole nother story. You'll hear about that tonight when I get to tell my story. But, you know, it, for me, it was more a matter of not being able to be present at all. Not ever able being able to be where I was. My head was always somewhere else, whether it was projecting to the future, reliving the past, constantly running those tapes, and I could never turn that volume down unless I had alcohol. I put alcohol in my system, and all of a sudden, the volume in my head became just ever so slightly less. And I was able to function and do the things that normal people can do, like get up and take a shower, you know, go to school, interact with human beings without wanting to murder them. You know, I used to say when I, in my active addiction, I used to say that alcohol kept me from killing myself and others. And it really did for me, it allowed me to just be human. The problem with that is that once I put alcohol in my system, I can't control how much I drink. There's that statement in the Big Book. It's in We Agnostics. It says that, you know, it says that if you can't control the amount that you drink when drinking, right, or you can't stay away from it, that you might be a real alcoholic, right? So essentially, the issue that I had as an alcoholic is the fact that I need this substance to be able to function, to be able to breathe, to be able to just get out my front door. The problem is that very substance that does that for me turned on me. And I love that in the doctor's opinion, he talks about it and he says that, and this is Dr. Silkworth and Bill, because Dr. Silkworth wrote all these letters and Bill edited it to, you know, and embellished and added his own stuff. So it's the doctor and Bill's opinion, but it's still just as worthy. But he talks about it. He says that our problems pile up on us and become astonishingly difficult to solve, right? That human power fails us if we're alcoholics, meaning that all the things that we use or do in order to control our drinking or to control ourselves no longer work, right? So the new boyfriend, the new job. I mean, the running line that I had in my life constantly was if my boobs were just a little bit bigger and I was 5 pounds skinnier, that everything would just be okay. You know, because I really thought that if I rearranged my external life, that somehow I wouldn't need to drink the way that I did. The problem was every time something changed in my external life, nothing changed inside of me. I didn't have that psychic change that one needs to have in order to recover from alcoholism. So I was constantly rearranging the chairs on, you know, the deck of the Titanic, you know, or as Tyler Durden from Fight Club says, polishing the brass on the Titanic. I don't know if you guys are Fight Club fans, but I found that to be a very spiritual movie. A lot of my personal philosophy has come from that movie. But that's a whole nother thing. But anyway. But the idea is that I was constantly polishing the brass on the Titanic. And I was constantly feeling the need to go back to this. And that's the mental obsession. My mind told me that this time it would be different, or that I needed it, or that I didn't care. And I was unable to think about the consequences of what would happen once I put alcohol in my system. So in the doctor's opinion, he really thoroughly goes through and explains what the nature of alcoholism is. He tells us that we need to have a psychic change in order to recover from that. What's a psychic change? Well, that's a fancy way of saying a spiritual awakening. The spiritual awakening that's necessary to recover from alcoholism is the spiritual awakening that is outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I've sponsored a lot of people over the years, and they've all had profound spiritual experiences. Some of them had them through the 12 steps, and some of them had them before they came into AA, during. And they'd ask me, well, why am I crazy? Why do I still think about alcohol? Why do I still have the mental obsession? I said, well, because those profound spiritual experiences are real. But they're not the profound spiritual experience that's necessary for me to recover from alcoholism. That's a very specific set of instructions that I need to follow. I follow those instructions, being the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that spiritual awakening happens, and the obsession to drink leaves me. Once the obsession to drink leaves me, I no longer put alcohol in my body, and therefore I don't set off the craving. Does that make sense to you? You guys following me with this? All right, I know I'm preaching to the choir, but I got to cover the basics. All right. So the idea is, what does all of this mean? What does this look like? And this is what I like to talk about is, what does it look like? Because the idea here is that every one of us has our own personal experience with alcohol, just like we have our own personal experience with God. We're all bringing these things to the table, and we're all sitting right here, right now, in this spiritual community, in this room, with all of our own personal experiences. Now, we have things in common. If you're an alcoholic, you have the physical allergy, the mental obsession, and the spiritual malady. Those are the things that define the disease of alcoholism. How those things express themselves in your life are completely different. There are people who come here who are stockbrokers and never lost anything. And there are people like me who lived on the streets. You know, I got sober at 18. I was a homeless drunk. I couldn't graduate from high school. I was incarcerated in mental asylum after mental asylum, put on all kinds of medications. I've been in 4-point restraints more times than I'd like to count. 4-point restraints is when they tie you to a bed. in the rubber room and take away your shoes. I died. So that's what those three things look like for me. And what they look like for you is something completely different. But those are those common bonds, those three aspects of what alcoholism is, are what allows us to have that identification. Now, the identification for the first step is really important. After that, it's really not. Because that's the beauty of this program of recovery, is that where I got sober, and I'm sure this doesn't happen here. I know you guys have great recovery. I've been here before. I've met you guys before. I know that you guys all do the deal, and nobody does this stuff. But where I got sober, people would say things like, you know, bring the body and the mind will follow. Just keep coming back. Just don't drink. They say things like, oh God, they say crazy things like think, you know, live and let live. You know, those slogans, those are Al-Anon slogans. Just point out, think is nowhere in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Live and let live, and easy does it, is in the chapter to the wives and the family afterwards, because they're Al-Anon slogans meant for the alcoholic when we're dealing with our family after we screwed them over for so many years, they can't tolerate us anymore. We come back and we say, oh, I'm sober and spiritual and everything's great. And Bill saying, easy does it, man. That's easy does it. There's no easy does it in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's easy does it when we're dealing with the people who we screwed over. You know, so they used to say things like that to me. They'd say, just relax. So I came into Alcoholics Anonymous the first time when I was 13 years old. My parents went to Al-Anon. They were very smart. I'm one of five kids. Four of us have darkened the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, so we're Irish. I'm going to blame genetics on that one. My parents are adult children of alcoholics. So they're pretty normal. I mean, they got their own, they're weird, but they're really wonderful people. I mean, that like my mother is a Eucharistic minister. My father's an usher in the church. They're upstanding members of society. They pay taxes. They, you know, they pay their mortgage. They have great credit. They're normal people. They gave birth to four spawns of the devil. Four of the most shiftless, disgusting, horrible human beings you will ever meet. So these poor people were completely unprepared for the hell spawn that they were going to raise. And I'm not kidding. So naturally, they needed some outside help. And I'm the youngest. I'm one of five, and I'm the youngest. So by the fifth child, they discovered this place called Al-Anon. I'm pretty sure it was my brother's fourth rehab that told them about Al-Anon. But they decided with me that they were going to try it. So they made me the example, which really pissed me off for a really, 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 really long time. I was really mad that I couldn't get away with some of the stuff that my older brothers and sisters did. Like my brother got to shoot heroin for 10 years without getting sent to rehab. You know. Meanwhile, I stumble home drunk, you know, with half my clothes covered in blood three times and I'm in rehab. I think that's not fair. They're interfering with my drinking. You know, so I got annoyed. I have since been what a good friend of mine from Al-Anon likes to call a visiting dignitary, meaning that I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who goes to Al-Anon and steals their secrets and brings it back to AA. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. We're talking about the doctor's opinion on alcoholism. But here's the deal. So my parents were pretty normal. They were regular people, four hellspawn. So I had three other alcoholics before me, setting a wonderful example in which I could pick up many, many devious tools. So I hit 13 years old and I'm drinking as an alcoholic because here's this amazing thing is that there are two schools of thought when it comes to alcoholism. And this is the way that I like to look at it. And you can disagree with me later. You can even get me in the parking lot and yell at me about this. But I think there are people who cross a line. I think there are people who are born alcoholic. I've sponsored many people who were able to drink with some level of control for a long period of time. At some point in their drinking, they lost the power of choice in drink, where they were no longer able to control how much they drank once they started. But there was a point in time in their drinking when they had some level of control. I was not one of those alcoholics. The first time I put alcohol in my body, I came home. I had a spiritual experience. I had the big O. The second, well, you guys know what the big O is, right? Nobody's laughing, so you don't. All right. I had an orgasm the first time I put alcohol in my body. That's the big O, by the way. Thank you. Earmuffs. I apologize. I have to admit, I'm from Jersey. I have a colorful vocabulary. God has not seen fit to remove some of the euphemisms I like to use, I think. I've been asking. He hasn't done it, so we're good with that. And I apologize if I offend any of you, but here's the deal. You guys have all watched The Sopranos, right? You know how we all talk. So here's the deal. I put alcohol in my body. I woke up, I came home, and I felt whole for the first time in my life. Once that happened, I was 9 years old, I felt the need to have more. I could not control how much I drank at 9 years old. My mind didn't tell me, oh, drink again. My mind said, I threw up everywhere. I ended up in my brother's room, passed out on his floor. And this was Thanksgiving. They thought it was going to be really funny if they gave the baby some wine. They didn't realize that the baby stole a bottle of Amaretta and went up to her brother's room and hid under his bed and drank the rest of it. So then my parent, I was found in a pool of vomit at 9, twitching. I didn't do that again for a little while. But somewhere along the line, so my mind didn't connect that experiencing alcohol poison. My mind connected that experience to alcohol good. We like that. We're going to do that again as soon as we humanly can. So I did. And so by the time I was 13 years old, my parents were looking at my first rehab. And I had been in Alcoholics Anonymous for 5 years before I was able to get any kind of sobriety. I had, because people told me things like, easy does it. They told me things like, bring the body and your mind will follow. They tell me, just don't drink and make a meeting. If I could just not drink and make a meeting, I don't have to come here. I could find something better to do with my time. I mean, I could join a crafting club. I could start crocheting or some crap like that. I mean, honestly, if I have the power to just not drink and come to a meeting and be fine, I'd rather join a cooler club, than Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll find something, awesome to do, something prestigious that makes me look good and makes people think I'm important. Instead, I'm here. Why? Because I don't have the power to do that. I don't have the power to just not drink and go to a meeting. And the reason for that is because I have that mental obsession and I have that spiritual malady and I have that physical allergy. I have a mind that tells me that I can drink. I have a body that says more now. And I have a spirit that tells me I'm a worthless piece of shit and I'm not worthy of breathing. And it says this stuff all the time. Not anymore so much. So naturally, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I spent 5 years in these rooms, in and out, dating everything under the sun, because I thought that if I got a boyfriend who had worked a program that I'd somehow get sober. I thought that going to dances were, were going to get me sober. I thought making coffee was going to do it. No one ever explained to me what alcoholism meant, what alcoholism was. So I spent 5 years in Alcoholics Anonymous claiming to be an alcoholic, not even aware of what it meant to be an alcoholic. No one ever pointed out to me that there was a big book. I mean, they gave me one and they said, you might want to read the stories in the back. And the sponsor who I had who gave me one had a big coffee stain in the middle of it. I'm pretty sure it was just on her coffee table. She was using it as a freaking coaster. So she hands me this coffee-stained big book, which is not, this is the big book I drag around to studies. It's a mess. But this coffee-stained big book and says, read the stories in the back and identify. So, and it was a third edition. And they were all old. And they all drank wallpaper remover and crap like that. And I remember, and meanwhile, I come in AA and I got a green mohawk. That's when your head's shaved and it's all sticking up and big spikes and it's green hair and purple hair and pink hair. I had spiked belts. I carried knives. I wore Doc Martens. Well, I still wear Doc Martens, but, some things never change. But, I came in with a mess, Misfits t-shirt and safety pins in my face, okay? And they tell me to read the stories in the back and identify. Well, I can't identify with that crap because that stuff didn't happen to me. Because I wasn't a Southern gentleman. I do not have a penis. I'm from North Jersey. That's way far from the South. By the way, that's North, South. I didn't identify with that. So I read the stories in the back. It didn't identify and said, I guess I'm not an alcoholic. I can go drink. So I did. I continued to put alcohol in my body. And guess what happened? Craving happened. So once I start drinking, I can't stop until somebody locks me up, which was my experience. So here's my personal experience with craving. I get out of my 97th rehab. I sign a contract with my parents swearing that I'm never going to hang out with those terrible kids again. That I'm going to grow my hair back. That I'm going to stop listening to that music. That I'm going to behave myself and go to school because I didn't go attend school at all. I didn't get out of the ninth grade because I never went to school ever. And I was thrown out of a school for the emotionally disturbed because apparently I was too disturbed for them. That's really not a lie. There's no exaggeration. In fact, one of my classmates from that school is in the program and has found me on Facebook. And she was like, I remember you. You were crazy. Like, I hope you're sober. And I'm like, I am. Anyway, so I get out of rehab. I spent a couple weeks hanging out, trying not to see those people. Usually hiding in my room wanting to die because I can't drink. I can't leave my house. My parents are watching me every second, every moment of every day. My shrink is calling me, patrolling the streets looking for me. You know, when I do escape, they all converge and hunt me down. So I had this wonderful therapist and my parents had great insurance and they had lots of money and lawyers. And I had all this stuff, all these resources to hunt me down, to interfere with my alcoholism. So I come out of rehab. I spent a couple weeks hiding out. Then I'd get this idea. If I climb out my bedroom window in the middle of February in a snowstorm and I go over to my friend's house, I know that they're going to have alcohol. Now, I can drink a little bit and climb back in my window and no one will know. So here's a typical Saturday night for Carrie Cosgrove. I climb out my bedroom window in the snow with Chuck Taylors. No socks, no jacket. I climb down the roof, and my window, there's two roofs, and I hop from roof to roof, and then I jump on the deck in the snow. And I walk over to my friend's house, which is about 15 minutes away. I climb up onto her porch, into her window. We drink a bottle of Jack Daniels. And then I gotta get out of her window and back into mine. That's the difficulty. So typically what happens is I either stomp through her house, wake up her parents, and then her parents call my parents because I'm too drunk to get out the window. Or I do get out the window, and I'm able to get part of the way home, and somewhere along the way, I fall over into some bushes, and then I throw up on my parents' front porch, and then I pass out. And then my mother hears a commotion, she comes downstairs, and she sees me laying there in my own vomit. Why do I do that? Now, I was locked up for 30 days away from alcohol, right? No alcohol in my body. I'm under house arrest. I got to climb out my window, which they did begin to board up after a couple of those incidents. I got to climb out my window because I'm on house arrest, right? And I got to go to my friend's house because my parents have now taken all the liquor out of their house because they know better. And I gotta go drink her liquor. Her parents' liquor. And I do all this without any alcohol in me. That's not craving, that's a mental obsession. That's my mind telling me that I have to do this because there's something not right with me. And I get to my friend's house and I think, I'm just gonna hang out, we're gonna watch, I don't know, The Lost Boys, whatever movie it is that we're watching because we're 13, 14 years old. And we're gonna just drink a little bit. And then play some Nintendo, of course, or Sega. That's how old I am. I'm going to go home. And no one will be the wiser. And at 14 years old, once I put alcohol in my body, alcohol decides for me when I'm going to stop. It decides for me how I'm going to get home. It decides for me how much noise I'm going to make, how many stairs I'm going to fall down, how many bushes I'm going to fall into, where I'm going to throw up, who's going to find me, and whether or not I'm going to actually half freeze to death laying on my parents' front porch in February. All of those things are beyond my control because alcohol is doing all of my thinking and all of my acting for me. Because once I put it in my body, I can't control how much I drink. I know what'll happen if I drink. I know that I'll end up in rehab again. I know that I almost froze to death last winter. I know all of these things. Yet once I put it in my body, it doesn't matter. Actually, before I put it in my body, it doesn't matter, honestly. But we're talking about craving. So once I put it in my body, I can't stop. That's craving. And here's the thing is that only happens in alcoholics. So whether that's happened to you twice or 1,000 times, the fact is that reaction to alcohol is limited to alcoholics. It never happens in the non-alcoholic. So when you have somebody who maybe, like myself, got sober young, was in AA for on and off for a long time and lied and cried and whined for a lot of years, how do you explain to them what it means to be an alcoholic without having them have to drink for 30 years? Well, we use the trifecta. Allergy, mental obsession, and spiritual malady. And that's why I said that each one of us comes here with our own drinking story. We have our war stories. Our war stories, they belong in 12-step calls. When an alcoholic calls me up, and they've never been to Alcoholics Anonymous, they need some identification. That's where the identification comes. But the purpose of the doctor's opinion, the purpose of there's a solution, more about alcoholism, the purpose of those pages is for an alcoholic to read that, identify, diagnose themselves an alcoholic, and then do something about it. So just identifying myself as an alcoholic is not the solution to my problem. It simply identifies what problem I have. Because as the doctor's opinion so perfectly put it, and I love this, and I have to read this every time. It says, the physician at our request gave us this letter and has been kind enough to enlarge on his views in a statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms that we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. So I might be crazy, squirrely, completely insane. I could be Charles Manson. That doesn't make me an alcoholic. That just makes me crazy. My body is as abnormal as my mind. That's what makes me an alcoholic. With the spiritual malady. Well, we'll get to that. It says that it does not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we're maladjusted to life, full flight of reality, or outright mental defectives. Now, I was in full flight of reality. I was an outright mental defective. And I was maladjusted to life. I was all three of those things. Doesn't totally solve the problem. Because here's the thing. You put me on some Prozac. Give me a good shrink. A nice little boyfriend to rub my toes. You know. I should be okay, right? Because I'm maladjusted to life. I'm full flight of reality and outright mental defective. So shrinks should fix that, right? Because their job is to help me to, you know, get in touch with reality. Isn't that a shrink's job? Right? I'm a mental defective, so there's something wrong with my brain. So, you know, give me some drugs. Give me some Prozac, some Zoloft. That should fix it, right? I drank while I was on those things. By the way, that's not a very good combination. If you want to kill your liver, that's a perfect combination to die. Anyway, so I'm maladjusted to life because I'm an angry, unhappy, blaming little shit. That's what I am. I have all these three of these things going on. I have a shrink. I have loving parents. I have all the money and resources at my fingertips. I have private schools. I have multiple therapists. I've been in some of the best rehabs in our country. I was in rehab with a drummer from Pearl Jam, okay? My parents put me in Club Med rehabs. State-of-the-art crap. And I drank again. Because if those things were the things that made me an alcoholic or made me drink, then I could just fix that stuff. I could rearrange the chairs on the deck of the Titanic and everything would be okay. But for me, because those things are not the things that make me drink. I came in here saying those things. I came in here saying I drink because I'm an alcoholic and I'm breathing. Breathing is a cause. Awareness, being awake, is a trigger. Want to know a trigger? You looked at me. You looked at me, so you must be thinking about me, and it can't be good because you're thinking about me, and I suck, so you know I suck, so therefore I suck, and I can't be here, and I gotta hide under the chair, so I gotta drink. These are the things, this is the way I think when I'm not treated. You know, I don't think like that so much anymore. Or I couldn't really be up here doing this. That wouldn't work. So these things were true to some extent. In fact, a considerable extent with some of us, me. But we are sure that our bodies were sinking as well. Our belief that any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out the physical factors is incomplete. So the reason why I'm harping, I'm telling these funny stories is because leaving out the physical factor of alcoholism is an incomplete explanation as to why I do what I do. Because if I could just fix all this stuff, then I wouldn't need to drink so much. I wouldn't need to be in flight from reality. But the fact is, I'm not in flight from reality. The fact is reality could be whatever it is, but I'm in flight from myself. Because inside me is a cesspool of fear and resentment. And I need to kill that. I need relief from that. And it's that cesspool of fear and resentment which makes me not care about the fact that once I put alcohol in my system, I can't control how much I drink. Bill knew that the first drink got him drunk. You know, he says it in his story very clearly. He says, I came to see that I could not take so much as one drink. Right? So what did he do? He was banging the bar. Because knowing that you can't drink will not get you sober. Knowing that the first drink gets you drunk will not get me sober. Self-knowledge avails me nothing. So I knew very well, long before I stopped drinking, that I needed to not take the first drink. But the fact is that was beyond my power. Because I'm powerless. And what being powerless means is that it's beyond my power, and I cannot, on my own power, on human power, using you, my parents, every shrink in the state of New Jersey, I cannot arrest my drinking with those things. The thing that is needed is an entire psychic change. And it says entire for a reason. In the doctor's opinion, it says entire psychic change. Why did Bill say entire psychic change? Not sorta. Not middle of the road. Not mostly psychic change. I like mostly psychic change. It meant that I could avoid paying back a whole lot of money. It meant that I didn't have to make amends to people I really didn't like. Because that's a mostly psychic change, right? A mostly psychic change is doing the stuff that I like doing. And not doing the stuff I don't want to. But he says entire psychic change. Why? Because we have to entirely do everything this book tells us to do in order to have that psychic change. You know, Dr. Silkworth says that we have to follow a few simple rules. Who says there are no rules in Alcoholics Anonymous? My book says there are rules. It says this is a suggested program of recovery, meaning that the program in toto, they're all 36 principles, that triangle, the three legacies, you know, that's a suggested program of recovery to recover from alcoholism. The individual principles are not suggestions. They're demands. They're musts. They're rules. You better or you're going to die. Bill says things like, in a fifth step, he says, you know, if you don't tell your fifth step all to one person, the most important reason is you're likely to drink again. He says things like, willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcoholism. Bill chose his words very carefully. When he wrote this book, in fact, that's why we had that whole thing about, you know, shortcomings and character defects. Can you give me the time signal yet? Okay, can you give it to me though? Okay, somebody. How are we doing on time? Okay. Just give me the cut. Anyway. So, I forgot. Oh, character defects and shortcomings. Bill had a thesaurus, okay? And he was an egotistical writer, so he made sure he didn't like to repeat himself, yada, yada, yada. So that's why, you know, he'll interchange things, but he's very careful about how he crafts things and things that he says. So when he says, you know, that we need to follow a few simple rules, when he says we must or we'll die, you know, we must be rid of selfishness, we must. I mean, he's not mincing words with this because he wants us to understand that it's an entire psychic change. Not a sort of psychic change. And so, in the doctor's opinion, it tells us that we have to have this entire psychic change. It says that frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. That a message which can hold an alcoholic has to have depth and weight. What does that mean? It means that I hope that what I'm talking about right now has depth and weight. Because the whole point of coming up to this podium and sharing with you, why did you guys pay to fly my butt out here? I mean, I'm a housewife. I actually live in Pennsylvania now. I keep saying Jersey because that's where I grew up. I'm a housewife from Pennsylvania. Okay? I got 4 kids. Married. Very happily. He said, we got sober on the same day. You'll hear more about that later. Probably, especially when we talk about sex inventory and resentments. Because we got sober together. Anyway, the point is that I'm a regular, run-of-the-mill, average person. There's nothing real special about me. Nothing. So why am I here? Well, one thing is there's a shortage of women who can talk about this stuff the way that I do because there just is. You know, and 2 is because the way that I talk about it has depth and weight, meaning that I'm bringing my personal experience and I'm informed with the facts about myself. It says later on in the book, and there's a solution. It says that an alcoholic who's informed with the facts about himself, right, can win the confidence of another alcoholic in a very short period of time. That every lawyer, judge, doctor, shrink, priest, nun, they're all great. They all mean well, but they can't win our confidence the way another alcoholic can. But the thing is that it's not just another alcoholic. It's another alcoholic who has recovered from this disease, recovered with an ED, not a sort of psychic change, an entire psychic change. With that experience, can win the confidence of you all in a short period of time by sharing my experience with you, what happened to me when I put alcohol in my body. Why these words in this book are so important to me, why the doctor's opinion is the foundation of what... It's the first chapter in the book for a reason, man. Bill's not dumb. Well, you know, he's not... They put it in the appendices. I don't even want to talk about what the renumbering of it. But the intent was that this was the first thing that one was supposed to read when one read this book. And it was mail order recovery, meaning that you didn't walk into a meeting and some people shake your hand and say, oh, you know, just keep coming back. Just get some coffee, sit in the back and shut up. No. You were dying somewhere in like Nebraska. You read the Saturday Night Post and you read about this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. You sent a letter to New York. They mailed you a freaking big book. You did what they said. You stopped drinking. And then you went to the insane asylum that you just broke out of and you got people sober. That's what it was about. Okay? So, these people were armed with the facts about themselves, right? So they were able to walk into that asylum that they walked out of a week before and win the confidence of the drunk that was shaking and rocking and rolling in that insane asylum, because they had an experience with this. And the thing is that we have to have this experience. We have to be awake. You know, and the fact is that this awareness that we develop as we progress on our spiritual path. I mean, I'm sober 16 years. The awareness I had at 5 years is much different than the awareness I have today. You know, and it's going to continue to evolve. But the fact is that the entire psychic change that occurred through practicing these or applying these principles and actually doing the directions of this book in the way that it's outlined, not in the way that I wanted to modify it. Because the fact is an alcoholic cannot get sober on their own terms. Because I don't know about you, but my book says all over that my way didn't work, the God's way did. You know, it says stuff like, you know, self will run riot. You know, and that's why when we're reading this chapter, it says, you know, follow a few simple rules. Why it says that we have to have this entire psychic change. Why it says that when we talk to another alcoholic, we have to have depth and weight. We have to bring to bear our experience, and that other alcoholics, people who are recovered and people who are not, will see the truth about who we are when we talk to them. Bill saw it in Ebby. Ebby had like, what, 3 weeks? Ebby hung out with Roland Hazard. Roland Hazard took him out of the asylum. They went through the 4 tenets, which became the 6 tenets of the Oxford group. He had this spiritual experience. He's down at the Calvary Mission, right? He's on fire with God. He knocks on Bill Wilson's door, and Bill Wilson, what does he say? He says, boy was on fire all right, right? He says, let him rant. My gin will outlast his rantings, right? So what does Ebby do? He calmly explains to him what it means to be an alcoholic. Calmly explains to him what the solution is. And Bill says his roots grasp new soil, right? Says that there was something different about him. So the idea is that even an alcoholic drunk off their ass, drinking gin in their kitchen for, what, a month on end, like Bill was, could see that a person who has a spiritual awakening as a result of the 12 steps and their message has depth and weight can see that, can recognize something that is profoundly different in an alcoholic who lives on a spiritual basis. Making sense to you? So the idea here is what it comes down to this thing. It says, so why do we drink, right? Well, the doctor's opinion answers it perfectly. It says that we drink essentially because we like the effect that alcohol produces. And that's that thing that I was telling you about, that with an alcoholic, we don't go down, we go up. We get that. Actually, truthfully, from what I understand and my limited understanding of biochemistry, because I don't have a degree in biochemistry, I have a degree in anthropology, which is really useless. But anyway, it was a lot of fun. The idea is that when an alcoholic puts alcohol in their system, their body, their brain secretes an opioid substance. So basically, when we drink alcohol, it kind of feels like dope. That's what our body creates. So an alcoholic who puts alcohol in their system gets that nice little feeling. We like that effect. We tell ourselves that it's okay. We tell ourselves we can't differentiate the truth from the false. The alcoholic life seems like the only normal one. So the idea is that I like that effect, and everything that I tell myself about why I do what I do is so I can continue to do what I do, and I begin to believe the excuses that I make to the point where I'm completely walled off from any sense of reality. The only thing that I know is me and alcohol, and I'm completely cut off. So what happens? When I don't drink, I'm irritable, restless, and discontent, till I can once again feel the ease and comfort which comes from taking a few drinks, drinks which I see other people taking with impunity. I do a lot of step work with people. I do a lot. I think like 3-4 days a week, I'm sitting at my kitchen table reading this chapter and every other one. So it's kind of in the gray matter. I'm not that smart. I'm just saying. The only reason why I'm pulling this stuff out of my hat after being up for 24, 25 hours now is simply because it's kind of tattooed on my brain. So what's the thing? So I'm irritable, restless, and discontent. That's the description of the spiritual malady, right? Drink, and I watch other people drink. I'm a drink watcher. When I'm an untreated alcoholic, I'm going to ask you to do something. You're not going to like it. I'm going to ask you to do it anyway. Who here watches other people drink and counts their drinks? Come on. Guess what, guys? Guess what? You're not going to like this at all. But alcoholics who watch other people drink have an alcoholic mind. You know what that means? Means that entire psychic change thing hasn't fully happened yet. Doesn't mean you didn't give it a good try, but it means that you probably missed something. Because for the first 5 years that I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, when I was drinking, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I watched people drink. And for the first 2 years that I was in Alcoholics Anonymous abstinent, I watched people drink until I had an experience with the 12 steps. And then 2 years ago, my father spilled a bottle of Guinness on me. And I smelled it and I said, I love the smell of Guinness. And then I changed my shirt. And that was all I thought about it. Because there's this beautiful thing when we say we're recovered from alcoholism. It means I'm recovered from alcoholism, which means I'm placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. I have to liquor up drunks to cart their ass to detox. I don't know how many times a month. I just detoxed somebody off of heroin on my couch just 2 months ago. Heroin and alcohol. That's a beautiful combination. And it's really disgusting to detox people off of that. Just saying. That was gross. But anyway, my point is that if I didn't have to wean this person off of heroin and alcohol on my couch, you know, if I had an alcoholic mind, I couldn't do that. So We watch other people's drinking with impunity. They get to drink as much as they want, and they don't pay the price that we pay. Why do we pay that price? Why is it that I can't drink with impunity? Because I'm an alcoholic. And there's a karmic law with being an alcoholic, meaning that if you know you're an alcoholic, you know what it means to be an alcoholic, and you still put alcohol in your system, you're screwing yourself twice. It's a karmic law. Think about it. How many people here have come into AA, found out a little bit about alcoholism, and then went out for some experimentation? How badly did it suck? How did you get in trouble, like, right away? You know, it took me 3 months, but yeah. But my point is that when we watch other people drink with impunity, is because when we're watching that, when we're doing that, is because what we really want to do is drink without the consequences of drinking. We want to feel that alcohol go through us. We want it to touch our little toes. We want it to go down our throat with that fire and warm our little cockles and just feel it's tuggled and snuggled up nice and tight in our little alcoholic blanket without having everybody get mad at us and losing our job and, you know, going crazy and sitting with a loaded shotgun on our kitchen table. You know, we don't want that stuff. We just want to feel nice and warm. That's the mind of the alcoholic. So when I'm watching, so what happens when I'm in that state, right? So I'm watching people drink, they're drinking, and I'm like, they're drinking, and they're not getting in trouble. They're doing shots of Jaeger, and they're fine, and I do a shot of Jaeger, and then all of a sudden I'm down in Newark, and then I'm naked, and bad things are happening, and I'm running naked through the barrio, and I'm wondering, where are my clothes? That really did happen. Yeah. So things like that happen to me when I'm drinking. It doesn't happen to other people, and I don't understand that. Well, here's the thing. It's when I watch other people drink like that, and I'm watching, and I'm really what I want is I want to drink without the consequences of drinking. I want my security blanket, and I don't want anybody to mess with me about it. It says, after I watch other people drink, and after they succumb to the desire again, as so many do, because that's my mind saying, you know what? It was really that boyfriend. You know, that boyfriend, he was such a jerk. And he made me drink like that because if he just respected me as the beautiful, confident woman I am, I wouldn't have to drink to forget the indignities that I have to deal with because I pick up his clothes, I cook his food, and, you know, I have to service him every now and again. I don't like, you know, if I didn't have to do those horrible, indignant things, I wouldn't have to drink, right? Right. If he didn't cheat all the time, maybe he's cheating because I'm cheating because I'm drunk, naked, running through the streets. I don't know. But anyway, the point is that if I can just change that stuff, if I can make that go away, then I can drink with impunity because it was those things, right? But no, because I'll pass through the well-known stages of spree, emerge remorseful, with a firm resolution never to do it again, right? But then what do? I do it again, and I'll keep doing it again, and doing it again, and doing it again, and doing it again, and doing it again until I have an entire psychic change. It says there's very little hope for my recovery. It says that, on the other hand, as strange as it may seem to those who do not understand, once the psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, Bill says doomed 3 times in the doctor's opinion. Why? And he says hopeless everywhere, by the way. Doomed and hopeless, hopeless and doomed and hopeless. Why? Because when I have the physical craving, the mental obsession, and spiritual malady, I'm screwed. I'm screwed. There's no hope for my recovery except for a relationship with a higher power, which I'm completely blocked off from because I'm crazy and full of fear. So there's got to be something that's got to kind of clean out those pipes and get me in contact with that higher power and get me to have a relationship with that higher power and teach me that I'm not my own higher power, which, or my mind, which I labored under that delusion for a really long time. And I was very unhappy. I think they called that clinical depression. I called that narcissism. Anyway, the idea here is that once we have this psychic change, we're doomed, right? We're not doomed anymore. That person who seemed doomed now, right, he says that we're easily able to control our desire for alcohol. The only requirement being we follow a few simple rules, the 12 steps. So I'm a doomed alcoholic who will continue this cycle of relapse and run and relapse and run until there's no relapse and run. I'm just drinking. And I'm just drinking. And there's no stopping. And there's no anything. And I'm just drinking. Right? And that's going to continue to happen until I have this entire psychic change. I have this entire psychic change by following a few simple rules. I didn't make this stuff up. I'm not that smart. I'm really not all that wise either. I'm taking it directly from the book and exactly how it was taught to me. And so, ultimately, the thing that I want to slam home and for you to take from this talk is that, one, there is hope that we can have that entire psychic change. It's not all that bizarre, and you don't have to sacrifice any llamas and, anything like that. You just got to pay back some money and make some amends, write some inventory. That's not all that hard. I mean, try waking up naked in Newark. That was hard. I don't know if you guys know what Newark is, but Newark is like bad. I think it's like number 5 in like the murder capital of the country in America. Yeah. It's got the highest HIV rate in the entire country. Yeah. So waking up naked in there, that's really bad. That's a lot harder to get home when you have no clothes in the middle of hell, Beirut, places like that, than to, write some inventory, maybe tell my sponsor some stuff and, pay back some money. That's a lot easier than trying to figure out how to get home, figure out where my clothes and my shoes are. I did find them, by the way. I left them in an abandoned car. I don't know why I was in there. But, but that's my point, It's a lot harder to do those things than it is to do that other stuff, the simple spiritual stuff, the simple rules. And ultimately it comes down to this thing is that we can have this physical problem and it can be irrelevant because if we treat the spiritual malady through the 12 steps, we recognize and diagnose ourselves an alcoholic, follow through with the program of recovery, we'll have a mind that no longer tells us that we need to put alcohol in our body and therefore the craving for alcohol will become irrelevant like it is for me today. My craving for alcohol is irrelevant to my daily life because I don't have a mind that tells me that I need to drink. Safe and protected. Anyway, thank you very much. And I'm going to be Carla.
Það fara bara allir út að dópa sem að vilja.